Searching the Scriptures with Watchman Alexander, Episode 22.
Is everybody in the world going to die before someone finds the answer?
Do I have to remind you that theory is the beginning of the solution?
What are we up against? Is it a dangerous thing?
All I've ever known to be true is a lie.
I didn't say it would be easy. I just said it would be the truth. I believe this is going to be our finest hour.
Welcome to Searching the Scriptures with Watchman Alexander, where we break away from religious systems and man-made dogma to learn the Word of God from an independent Hebraic perspective. And now your host, the prophecy buff who tackles the tough stuff, Alexander Lawrence.
Hello and shalom, and welcome back. That's right, after a long hiatus, I'm back to podcasting, and I'm here to wake up the sleeping servants of Yahweh God and equip them for the last days. I do that by teaching discernment, poring over prophecies, treating the infection of Mystery Babylon in the church, and giving you courage. I'm glad to be back with you because the hour is late, the time is short, and the storm is coming. So let's get back to our study called Laying the Foundations. We're still in Genesis chapter 1. We've really only gotten started. There's so much ground to cover. We have to understand the basics before we can get to the more advanced stuff. So back to Genesis we go, and we're going to actually complete Genesis chapter 1 and go a little bit into Genesis chapter 2 today. Primarily, we're going to be talking about the soul and the spirit and what exactly it means to be a living nephesh. But first, before we start that, let me catch you up to what's been going on. I have been a busy guy. I recently completed the online learning series that I started back in late November of 2017. That course is about the book of 2 Baruch, and it ended up taking a lot longer than I thought because, number one, I set the quality bar as high as I could within reason. And number two, I ended up not being able to devote full time to it as I originally intended. I had to instead go back to doing some freelance work and other work to get by while I did that on the side. But it's now completed. It took a while, but I'm happy to be finished with it. And I'm really happy with the end product. That's available right now at my online academy, Watchman Alexander Academy, which is hosted by Teachable. But it's also soon going to be available on Blu-rays, the whole set of 12 lectures, plus a link to be able to download the participant's guide, which you can print out yourself, or you can just look at it on the computer and write the notes, write the answers down on a separate piece of paper as you go through the lessons. So that Second Brute course is the main reason that I haven't been podcasting very much, but I've also been doing some other things. I've been working on the prophecy cheat sheet a little bit here and there. It's still in progress. I thought I'd have it done by now, but unfortunately, I just haven't been able to dedicate enough time. But the other thing that I've been doing is writing the first four chapters of a new novel. I got inspired. I had this idea for a whole saga of fiction novels just drop into my head. And these novels would be based on the research I did for Leviathan's Ruse. So this is not a completely new thing. This ties in with the work I've already been doing. But I realized, and the Lord has been just impressing it on me lately, that the way to reach more people is through entertainment. And I've always loved to write. I've written fiction, although I haven't ever published anything, but I've written short stories. I've started novels. I wrote a script for a short animated film, which won an award. So I have been a writer for many years. I just haven't published much aside from Leviathan's Ruse, which is nonfiction. But now I'm ready to do some fiction that is set in a historical biblical setting. And I'm really excited about this. I have a crowdfunding campaign planned. I've been putting together artwork and figuring out which rewards are going to be offered and been doing everything related to beginning a Kickstarter campaign. And that's going to be ready to go within the next couple of weeks. So I'm finishing artwork right now, but I'm more than halfway done making all the art pieces that I need to make. And I'm just so excited about what's going to happen with that. So I hope you'll stay tuned. Sign up for my newsletter, please, if you want to be informed when the campaign kicks off and also get other updates as we go on things like these new novels. The first one, by the way, is called Reign of the Rebel. The entire saga is probably going to be called The Imposter King Saga. That's a working title. It may change, but Reign of the Rebel is definitely the title of the first book. In addition to that, if you're on the newsletter, you'll get updates about the Prophecy Cheat Sheet and any new podcasts and teachings that I come out with that I think are particularly helpful. I don't spam my newsletter subscribers. I don't send stuff out all the time because I know that that's annoying. I don't like receiving things from people all the time. There's a couple of exceptions. There are a few people out there that just write exceptionally great emails or provide exceptionally valuable content. And for those people, I don't mind reading a newsletter once a week or so. But for other stuff, I'd rather receive less emails than more because I have so many emails in my inbox. I'm sure some of you guys can relate to this. It just fills up incredibly quickly. So I'm constantly deleting stuff and unsubscribing from things that send me too much. And I don't want to be one of those guys. So I'm not going to spam you. You'll get very few emails from me, but you're going to get the important stuff. So if you want to be on the newsletter, please go to my website, WatchmanAlexander.com, and just scroll down to the bottom of any page, and you're going to find a link to sign up. And also, you'll get a free gift. You're going to get an ebook called The 8 Keys to Personal Moral Excellence just for signing up for the newsletter. Another thing I want to make you aware of is that these solo podcast episodes are going to be a half hour now instead of an hour. I just have too many plates spinning. I don't have time to plan out an hour's worth of content each week. So I'm going to cut these down to half an hour. It's a lot more manageable for me. But the interview episodes that I do will still be an hour. Half an hour often just isn't enough time for a guest to get through the entire topic that they've been brought on to talk about. So I want to make sure they have plenty of time to do their thing. So again, half hour for the solo podcast episodes, an hour for the guest interviews. One more thing, if you guys wouldn't mind, would you pray for my mother? She has a couple of major surgeries coming up. She's been having some serious medical problems, and this is going to be a logistics nightmare because my father works out of state, and he can only get off of work to go back home every so often, and he can get 1 month of leave per year. So for the first surgery, he's going to be able to go back home for a month and take care of my mom while she recovers and take care of their homestead. But for the second one, she's going to have to get somebody else to try and take care of the homestead. She's got somebody that might be able to do it, but that's not locked down yet. And most likely, my family is going to have to take care of her during that time of recovery. And I don't know how that's going to work out because I don't know what my work situation is going to be like. Will I continue to do freelance work throughout the end of the year? Will I get a part-time job? Will I have to get a full-time job? I don't know. And so it's all really up in the air right now. And we just need God to orchestrate these events for us. And he is more than able to do that. But if you wouldn't mind, just please send up a quick prayer and ask him to, number one, take care of my mom. Number two, help us to get it all organized so that everything clicks into place and works well. Thank you so much for that. Okay, let's get started on the fifth day of Genesis. Last time we spoke, we talked about day four and how God had created signs for us using the heavenly bodies. But now we're going to talk about the creation of life on earth. Day five is when God created all the creatures of the sea. The Genesis account tells us only about those things called living creatures or living souls. It does not tell us about the creatures that are not living. That statement probably sounds very strange to a modern audience because we think about life based on a modern scientific definition. Science says that a thing is living if it breathes, reproduces, eats, and I think there's a couple of other qualifications, but basically anything from a bacteria to an insect all the way up to an elephant is considered living. But that is not the biblical definition of living. It's much narrower. There are creatures in the world which are not living. Bacteria are not living souls. Insects are not living souls. Plants are not living souls. And yes, I have seen people claim that plants have souls. No, they do not. They have spirits. Every living thing has a spirit that animates it because an animating force is necessary to move the pieces within the cells so that those cells will create together an organism that has growth. Just because something reproduces and grows and consumes does not mean it is a living soul. We're going to talk more about that in a minute, but let me just read to you Genesis chapter 1, verse 20, which describes the fifth day. Elohim said, "Let the water teem with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth in the open dome of the sky." Elohim created the great sea creatures and every living thing that creeps or glides, that's my little editor's insertion, so that the water swarmed with all kinds of them, and there was every kind of winged bird, and Elohim saw that it was good. Then Elohim blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful, multiply, and fill the water of the seas, and let the birds multiply on the earth." So there was evening and there was morning, a fifth day. There's a couple things that we need to point out in this passage. Number one, the Hebrew word used for great sea creatures is the word tananim. We're going to discuss tananim in detail in a second. The other thing I want to point out is in verse 21 in this translation, a word is used, creeps, every living thing that creeps. But that translation is not best, and other translations will say something like moves instead of creeps. The Hebrew word used there is ramaz, and ramaz usually means something that glides or swiftly moves along, not necessarily creeping along low to the ground like most of us would think when we hear that English word. What this verse is saying is that God created everything that glides along with a living soul in the waters. Now, let's talk about great sea creatures. Many translations will say whales, which is completely incorrect. This is not talking about whales, although whales are probably included here in the larger category of living souls that glide. But specifically, the tananim are dragons. These are sea dragons. Of course, through the context, we understand that these are dragons of the sea. There are dragons on land as well, and we're about to see that in other verses. Now, tan means jackal, and there's oftentimes a lot of confusion because the word tan is so similar to the word tanin that in some places in the scriptures, there were scribal errors where tanin got turned into tan. It became jackal, and the plural of tan is tanim, but the singular of dragon is tanin, and the plural of dragon is tananim. So this can be very confusing, as you just heard, because of the similarities. So let me repeat it one more time. Tan is jackal. Tanin is dragon. Tananim is the plural dragons. Tanim is the plural jackals. In any case, how do we know that in Genesis 1:21, we're talking about dragons here instead of whales or some other kind of sea creature? Well, let's look at a few other verses. In Isaiah chapter 27, verse 1, the prophet talks about what will happen with this great dragon called Leviathan. Now, we know from Job and other verses that Leviathan is a real dragon in the sea. But this is also a spiritual concept. This dragon represents a spirit entity, actually a group of spirit entities. And we're not going to get into all that, but the fact is that Isaiah 27:1 tells us that Leviathan is a tanin. It is a dragon, specifically a sea dragon. So that's pretty clear that a tanin has to be a serpent of some kind. In Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 33, Moses uses poetic parallelism to equate a cobra with a tanin. So a snake on land can also be a tanin. And in Exodus chapter 4, verse 3, we see that Moses' staff supernaturally turns into a snake. But in Exodus 7:9, Aaron's staff also turns into a serpent. But in this case, the word there is tanin. So most likely, Aaron's staff turned into the same kind of creature that Moses' staff turned into, which was a serpent. But the word tanin is used here, which is just a broader category, and snakes of all kinds fit into that category. Let's go also to Job chapter 7, verse 12, where one of Job's friends says this to him, "Am I the sea or some sea monster that you put a guard over me?" The word sea monster here is tanin. Now, he's associating tanin with the sea in this instance, but it's not always associated with the sea. But what he's talking about is what we would call the aquatic dinosaurs, the massive reptilian and serpentine creatures that lived in the sea before the flood, and probably to some degree after the flood, although they in large part died out because of the change in environment. These creatures were so fearsome, you had to guard against them. That's why he's saying, am I like one of these things that you have to protect yourself from? Am I some kind of a monster? No, I'm not a monster. I'm trying to help you, so listen to me. Also, Ezekiel chapter 29 contains a reference to tanin when God says to Pharaoh, "I am against you, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, you big crocodile lying in the streams of the Nile." Now, the word here is not crocodile, it's tanin. However, a crocodile would fit under the category of tanin. God probably is talking about a crocodile because that was the kind of serpent that, more than any other, was found in the Nile. However, this address to Pharaoh is actually also an address to the spirit behind Pharaoh, which is the great dragon, Ha-Satan, the adversary who is serpentine. The book of Revelation tells us he is a red dragon. So there's a double entendre happening here. He's talking about Pharaoh by making an analogy to a crocodile, but he's also talking about Hasatan by making an analogy to Pharaoh. Those references I gave you are not the only references in the scripture to Tanim, but that's enough for right now. I think you get the point that this is not just some random sea creature. This is not just a whale. These are the massive dinosaurs that lived in the seas and existed even in Job's day. Some people say that dinosaurs aren't in the Bible, but that's just not true. Behemoth, described in Job, is a land dinosaur. Leviathan was a sea dinosaur. And there are fiery flying serpents that are talked about in the book of Exodus, which may very well have been pterodactyls or some other kind of flying dinosaur that was serpentine in appearance.
Hold it right there, Watchmen. Get a cup of tea. It's time for Everything Under the Sun when we take 3 minutes to hear from the Watchman's wife, Amanda Lawrence.
In the house where I work as a nanny, there's a dog. It's a big black dog, and he's a Labrador retriever, and his name is Meatball. I think the original plan was for them to get a yellow lab and name it Noodles. Noodles and Meatball. Anyway, he loves water so much. So last week, I took him down to the creek right by the house, and he spent about a half hour just running back and forth and back and forth. He is so happy. Anyway, this part of the podcast isn't about dogs. It's about Jesus. So let's get to it. While he was still in the water, he was trying to shake off the excess water that was in his fur. So he's standing haunch deep in water, shaking and shaking and shaking. And I said, Meatball, why are you trying to shake it off while you're still in it? Oh, hallelujah. And I knew that I was going to make an Everything Under the Sun about that very topic. So surrender. How are we supposed to let go of issues in our lives if we're not fully out of it yet, if we haven't really laid it down and surrendered it at the cross? This is something that I struggle with. There are areas in my life that I recognize are issues and that I know that I don't want to continue doing these things, but I'm still not really ready to lay it down. Or I think I am, or I am for a moment or for a day or so. And then I go and I pick it right back up. And it's like, thanks for holding this for me, God, but I'll handle it from here. That won't work. That has never worked in my life. And for some reason, I still keep thinking that I can control areas in my life and that I can manage them without fully letting go. There's a saying that I have probably said on another podcast here, but it's everything I've ever let go of has claw marks on it. And that's very true. I want to control my own life. And part of that is actually rooted in feeling guilty that I'm laying too much down for Jesus. And I'm feeling like I'm overwhelming him with my requests. And that's simply not true. And I know that that's not true, but I feel like a burden, which is super silly. It just comes down to surrender. I'm sure some of you need to work on putting things down, completely down, and walking away from it. If there's a person in your life who is toxic, you need to cut all ties with that person. Get them off your social media, get them off your phone, get them out of your life. If there are hobbies, things in your life that you know don't point to Yahweh, you have to let it go. And that's really all there is to it. I don't have any big theological insight here. We just have to let it go. We have to take our hands off of these things that we clasp so tightly to our chest because we know that there's something better. There's so much more that we can get through God if we're willing to let go of what we think is more important than he is. There are, of course, scriptures to back this up, and lots of other insights from other books and resources. So if you would like to get some of those sent to you, just send me an email at thewatchmanswife@gmail.com.
Thanks, Amanda. Now that I've finished my Winchester special, Plain Black Tea, we can jump back into the study. Let's talk about living creatures. What does the scripture mean when it talks about the living soul? The words in Hebrew are Nefesh Chaya. Nefesh Chaya means soul that lives. Chai is life in Hebrew. So Chaya is living. Nefesh is a soul. The word nefesh does not mean just a disembodied soul. When we talk about soul in English, we oftentimes are thinking only of the disembodied or immaterial part of a person. That's not the case in Hebrew. In Hebrew, nefesh means the entire individual or the entire animal, both the material part and the immaterial part. So the scripture talks about souls going down into the underworld, but it also talks about living people upon the earth being souls, that they are living souls. Genesis chapters 1 and 2 use the term nefesh chaya quite a lot. In fact, it's all about creatures with living souls. We're not told about the ones that don't have living souls. Genesis is very concise, and it just doesn't take the time to describe that stuff. What's important to us, what's important to this whole redemptive story, are the creatures that have souls. Evidently, the creatures that glide in the waters, including the great dragons, have souls. What's not included here are creatures like mollusks and sea anemones and starfish, shrimp and crabs. These things don't fit that category, and we're going to see why a little bit more here in just a minute. Day 6 talks about the creation of all the land animals that have souls. And then after the land animals are created on day 6, God also makes mankind. He is the last to be created, and he is at the top of the hierarchy. All of the other living creatures are put under his command. In fact, the whole earth is put under the authority of Adam. After man was created, he gave him an instruction. He said, "Every seed-bearing plant and every tree with seed-bearing fruit is given to you as food." And then he speaks to the wild animals and says something similar. He says, "Every wild animal, bird in the air, and creature on the earth in which there is a living soul," again, nefesh chaya, "I am giving as food every green kind of plant." So, the living souls upon the earth were only supposed to eat plants. They were vegetarians initially. They were not to eat each other. However, this does not tell us what the things that are not living souls were eating. There's a misconception within Christendom that death did not exist at all prior to the fall. But the scripture never says that. It says that living souls and human beings did not die prior to the fall. But death among things that are not living souls probably was happening before the fall. After all, plants have to die in order for us to eat. God just said, "Go eat plants." Well, if you think about plants as being living things, then eating them means that there was death in the world. That would be a contradiction of the idea that death only existed after the fall. But it's not a contradiction, because plants don't have souls. If Adam stepped on an insect, oops, he crushed an ant. Did that mean he just killed a living creature, that death had entered into the garden if Adam stepped on an ant? No, because an ant doesn't have a soul. That kind of death already existed. It wasn't considered evil. It was considered part of the process. It was just part of the cycle of the natural world. However, creatures with souls were not supposed to be part of that cycle. They were outside of that. They were supposed to be without death. And only when Adam, the authority figure, sinned, did everything under his authority become vulnerable to the enemy called death. Even Yeshua said that a seed must fall and die before it can create a new plant. Those things were already occurring. So if you ever hear a critic of the Bible saying, there had to have been death before the fall, that does not mean there is a contradiction within the scripture. It simply means they haven't read it closely enough, because it's only the things with living souls that can be considered to die. Other creatures may perish, but they don't die in the sense that the Bible speaks of death as a result of sin. Plus, if there was no death at all, then why would there have been a tree of life? And why would God have needed to protect that tree so that Adam, after sinning, couldn't get to it? A tree of life only makes sense if there's already death present. You can't have one thing without the other. There's a contrast there. You have to compare them to each other. All right, let's go to chapter 2, and let's read the second account of the creation of man. Man was created from the dust of the earth, and then God breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, so that he became a living soul. Now, the Hebrew word for breath here is neshama. Don't get confused between nefesh and nashama. These are two separate things, but they are related. So the nashama was given to Adam, who was just a clump of cells at that point, and then he became a living soul. Now, he was distinct from the other living souls in the world because he was created in God's image. We're told that in chapter 1, verse 26. God says, "Let us make humankind in our image." So he was a special and set apart creature, but he was still a living soul, just like every other living soul. So when people say, "Well, we're just like the animals," that's true in large part. We are living souls as they are living souls. But we're also special because we are created in God's image, and we have a special ability to be able to create, to think forward to the future, to imagine, to do many things that animals cannot do. Neshama is literally breath that comes from the spirit, ruach. Now, God used his spirit, his ruach, to breathe into the man. He introduced neshama, and he became a soul. There are some rabbis out there who will teach you that neshama is the godly part of the soul, and the nefesh is the animal part of the soul. To be blunt, that's complete nonsense. The Bible never presents it that way. So if you hear that kind of teaching, please disregard. Let me give you just one verse that contradicts that teaching. Daniel chapter 10, verse 17 says, "For how can this servant of my Lord speak with my Lord when my strength and breath have failed me?" Breath is the Hebrew word neshama. Daniel would not have been saying, "The neshama, the godly part of my spirit, is failing me." In the context of this chapter, he's simply overwhelmed. He's physically burdened by the encounter that he's having with the angel and the things that he's being taught. So his strength is leaving and he's having a hard time breathing. It's almost like a panic attack, an anxiety attack. When your breath changes, it becomes difficult to breathe. This has nothing to do with his morality. This has nothing to do with his spiritual state. This is purely a physical, visceral reaction to what is happening in his world at that moment. Okay, so God's spirit, his ruach, gave Adam this breath that turned him into a living soul. Not every creature has neshama. Neshama is basically the vertebrates. It's also the creatures that vocalize. In Genesis chapter 9, God told Noah not to eat blood, not to eat any creature with its blood still in it, or to drink the blood separately. The reason he gave for this is that the life is in the blood. Medical science used to not think that that was the case. That's why they bled people when they got sick. They thought there was something in the blood that needed to be removed. But in fact, the life force of a person is in their blood. It's important to keep as much of it in our bodies as possible. Well, the blood of creatures that have a nefesh is almost always red, especially the higher order animals. They all have red blood. Now, there are a few fish that live in the very deep seas that don't have red blood. They have clear blood, for instance. But almost all other fish even have red blood. It's only some of the invertebrates, the animals that do not have a nefesh, that have blood of other colors like blue and green. Every vertebrate, unless it lives under exceptionally strange environmental conditions that require some other kind of transport mechanism within the blood, has red blood. Red blood has the life, the chai, in it, and it's not right to ingest the soul force of another creature. Did you know that Adam means red or ruddy? That has dual meaning because he came from the soil or the clay, and soil is red. Soil may not seem red. You might say, "Oh, soil is brown," but actually brown is a desaturated red. Sometimes the soil has a little yellow in it, so it becomes more of a desaturated orange, but you can also get clay, which is very red. It's quite a bit more bold than your normal color, but yes, brown, red, and even desaturated orange all sits in that same part of the color spectrum. So not only did Adam come from the soil, but he breathes and oxygenates his blood cells, which turn red, and that gives us the red tone to our skin color. Whether you're very white or very black, it doesn't matter. Everyone is a various shade of brown and red. And when people get sick or they die, they lose that red because the cells are no longer being oxygenated. They become pale, sickly color or a bluish color because they've lost that life in their red blood cells. But the word neshama is not only about breath that fills up your lungs, it's also about sound. There's something about moving wind and making a sound with it that separates these creatures, the creatures with nefesh, from other creatures. Only creatures with nefesh vocalize. It's amazing that we don't classify things anymore how the Bible does. Science never looks at the animal kingdom this way, but the only creatures who can make vocal sounds are the ones with a nefesh. Now you may be thinking, what about fish? Because that was my first thought. Do fish make sounds? And yet fish were included in the Genesis 1 account of living creatures, you know, ones that swarm and glide through the water. They are said to have living souls. So what about fish? They don't vocalize. Actually, they do. We didn't really know that until fairly recently, because when people went in the water with scuba diving equipment, they made a lot of noise and you can't hear the fish because of all the bubbles. Also, the fish tend to run away from people who are diving with that kind of equipment. But now with technology, we can put special listening devices into the water and we find that many, many types of fish make vocalizations. Probably all of them or nearly all of them do. And the ones that don't are exceptions to the rule. It's not that they couldn't, it's just that they don't or we don't know about it yet. But fish do indeed store air in these sacs called bladders, and by squeezing or vibrating them in a certain way, they can make sounds that communicate with each other, and in many cases, this is important to their survival and to being able to find other fish to mate with. Insects, on the other hand, don't breathe. They take in oxygen, but they don't breathe. They have special conduits in their body through which oxygen can enter and carbon dioxide can leave, but they cannot vocalize. Yes, they can make sounds. Sometimes they'll click parts of their exoskeleton or they'll rub parts of their exoskeleton. They can buzz with their wings, but these are not vocalizations. They're sounds made with other parts of their body. And as you're probably aware, sound and speech is very important in the biblical narrative. It starts with God speaking things into existence. And always throughout the scriptures, we find that there is power in speech. There's something special about being a creature that can vocalize. Let's study the neshama a little bit more. I'm going to take you to a few different verses. The first three are in the book of Job. Job chapter 32, verse 8 says this, "But it is the spirit in a person, the breath from Shaddai, that gives him understanding." In this verse, Job links the ruach, spirit, and the breath, neshama, with this thing called understanding. That's strange because it seems like in the Genesis account, the neshama is what gives life, not understanding. This verse expands how we think about the neshama, and we need to acknowledge that the neshama is multifunction. We'll see more about that here in a second. Let's go over to the next chapter, 33, verse 4. "It is the Spirit of God that made me, the breath of Shaddai that gives me life. It is the ruach of Elohim, the Spirit of God that made me. The breath," again, neshama, "of Shaddai, the sufficient one, it gives me life." So in the previous chapter, he said it gives him understanding. In this one, it gives him life. Now let's look at chapter 34, verse 14. Speaking of God, one of Job's friends says, "If he were to take back man's heart to himself, if he gathered to himself his spirit and breath, all flesh would instantly perish. Everyone would return to dust." This is theologically very important. If God were to withdraw his spirit, his ruach, and neshama, then all flesh would perish. Everything that has a soul would die together and would all return to dust. What's going on here is that the ruach creates the neshama. The neshama is a result in the physical world that comes from the spirit, which is the animating force. So the ruach is the energy and the will from the spirit that gets turned into a particular effect in the material realm, namely life, but also evidently understanding. Let's keep going. Let's take a look at Psalm 18, verse 15. "The channels of water appeared, the foundations of the world were exposed at your rebuke, Adonai, at the blast of breath from your nostrils." The psalmist is talking about the creative work of Adonai. And he says that the foundations of the earth were exposed when God blasted breath from his nostrils. Now, of course, this is figurative speech. This is an analogy. But it's also, in a very real sense, true. Because the Spirit of God comes into the world in the form of a breath or a blast or a wind. Ruach not only means spirit, but wind. The neshama from his nostrils accomplishes something in the material realm. Let's hop over to Proverbs chapter 20, verse 27. The lamp of Yahweh is the life breath of mankind, searching all the chambers of his inner being. Life breath there in that verse is neshama. So the lamp of Yahweh is called neshama. This is going to make a lot of sense when we look at the next verse. Revelation chapter 4, verse 5. John is in the heavenly throne room. He says, "From the throne came forth lightnings, voices, and thunderings, and before the throne were seven flaming torches, which are the sevenfold Spirit of God." Other translations will say seven lamps, which are the sevenfold Spirit, the sevenfold Ruach. This is so fascinating to me because the Ruach, singular, has seven divisions, or there's seven spirits that comprise the Spirit of the living God. These are compared to lamps. We know that in the earthly temple, there was a menorah. God required the Israelites during the time of the tabernacle to put a menorah, a seven-branched lampstand, in the temple, in the holy place, and each one of those branches was topped by an oil lamp. Those lamps and those lights were a reflection of the sevenfold spirit that existed in the heavenly realm. Everything in the earthly temple was meant to teach us something about what exists in the heavenly temple. According to Revelation 3:1, it is Messiah himself, Yeshua, who possesses these seven spirits. John writes to one of the churches, "Here is the message from the one who has the sevenfold Spirit of God and the seven stars. The one who has the sevenfold Spirit is their Lord, Yeshua." Well, Revelation didn't just come up with this whole sevenfold spirit thing. It was already spoken of by a previous prophet. Everything that God tells us is confirmed by two or more witnesses. So in this case, Isaiah is a witness for us. Let's go back to Isaiah chapter 11, verse 2. Speaking prophetically of the Messiah, Isaiah writes, "The Spirit of Adonai will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and power, the Spirit of knowledge and fearing Adonai. He will be inspired by fearing Adonai." Now that list only gave us six different spirits: wisdom, understanding, counsel, power, knowledge, and fear. Where is the seventh? I would like to suggest that the seventh is life, because we're talking about the Spirit of the living God here, the Spirit of Yahweh. And Yahweh is the source of all life. He is the energy and the mind that makes all things that exist. Therefore, his Spirit is primarily life-giving energy. So if we take that as a given, then we do have seven spirits. And notice that understanding is one of them. That's what Job mentioned. He said it's his spirit through the neshama that gives him understanding. The understanding being put into his brain is being carried out through the breath, the thing that comes from the spirit, the animating force, and produces a result in the mind of Job. Let's take a look at one more verse. This one's also in Isaiah. It comes from chapter 42, verse 5. "Thus says Elohim, Yahweh, who created the heavens and spread them out, who stretched out the earth and all that grows from it, who gives breath to the people on it and spirit to those who walk in it." Some translations of the Bible will say, "he who gives breath to the people on it and the spirit to those who walk on it." But that's not actually what the Hebrew says. The Hebrew says, "those who walk on her and the spirit to those who walk in her." And I say her because the noun aretz, or earth, is feminine in Hebrew. So we have a juxtaposition here. The breath is given to people on the earth. The spirit is given to those who are in the earth. The neshama is given to the people on the earth, and the ruach is given to the people in it. Now, I'm not a Hebrew scholar, and I don't know for sure that this is a legitimate thing that I'm trying to point out here. It could be that saying in and on are the same thing. I don't know. I haven't asked a Hebrew speaker yet. But if you are one, please write to me and let me know whether or not I'm on the right track here. My address is admin@watchmanalexander.com. My gut reaction is that the breath, or the neshama, being given to the people here is given to those on the earth because they are ones who still have living bodies. So they are living souls who also have living bodies. Their bodies haven't perished so that their soul goes down to the underworld. But for those who are in the underworld, the spirit, the ruach, not the breath, is empowering them. The disembodied soul that exists in Sheol, the underworld, still has to be maintained by the Spirit of God. The Spirit is what gives energy and life to everything. Without it, you can't even exist. So even after you've passed away and you're waiting in the underworld for the resurrection, you're still being maintained by God's Spirit. But you have no body. You have no physical form anymore. Therefore, there is no breath in you. The neshama can't do anything on your disembodied soul. It only works on living creatures and material objects. This is the only way that I can see to understand these concepts when we take all these verses into account. I hope that gives you something to chew on. Please test everything. Dive in and do a study of the Hebrew on your own. Don't just trust me. And if you do a systematic study and you come to different conclusions, please write to me. Let me know, and if I find it to be true, then I'll come back in a future episode and I will revise what I've taught. We're all brothers and sisters who are being empowered by the same Spirit, who doles out a little bit to this person and a little bit to that person, and we have to come together as a body to get the fullest understanding. So again, I invite you to participate and let me know what you find. And if you have any questions about the scriptures at all, please feel free to write me at questions@watchmanalexander.com. I will make sure to get your question answered in a future episode. That wraps up episode 22 of Searching the Scriptures with Watchman Alexander. Until next time, be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. Watchman out.